From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday. I'm your host, Evan Dawson, and this hour we will focus on the topic of micropreemies, families and doctors of babies born under 1 3/4 pounds, or about 700 to 800 grams, face critical medical and ethical decisions. These babies are called, you might call them micropreemies, and we've got two experts here in studio with us ready to discuss these issues and take your questions as well. We're pleased to be producing this hour in association with a national public television show, Second Opinion. Second Opinion is produced by WXXI Public Broadcasting and the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York. And today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series. You can watch this program on the web at secondopinion-tv.org. And you can participate in today's conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255, or you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. Our guests in studio today are Dr. Carl Danjo from the Golisano Children's Hospital at the University of Rochester Medical Center, where he's a professor of pediatrics and medical humanities and bioethics, the director of neonatal clinical research, and the director of the research ethics program. Dr. Danjo, nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Also here is Dr. Patricia Chess, also from the Golisano Children's Hospital at the University of Rochester Medical Center. She is professor of pediatrics, neonatology, and biomedical engineering, and director of neonatal perinatal medicine fellowship program there. Dr. Chess, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Welcome to you both. Drs. Chess and Dr. Danjo are going to be answering your questions throughout the hour. So we welcome your calls at 844-295-295. Talk. And a special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It's through their generous support that we can provide you with timely, accurate, and valuable health information. And thank you to our public radio and television supporters who help us make shows like this one possible. Let's get started, and I'd like to start with just understanding terms. You know, I hear the term micropreemie, but we also hear premature, preterm, extremely preterm, and then micropreemie. And I think it's important to know what the distinctions may be or how we define them. So how can we offer some definitions for our audience as a starter?
Well, the terms extremely low birth weight and the slang version, micropreemie, really originated many years ago when the best estimate of a baby's maturity was weight. And so a low birth weight infant was under 2,500 grams, which is about 5.5 pounds. And a very low birth weight infant was under about 1.5 kilograms, which is about 3 1/4 pounds. And then an extremely low birth weight infant was under 1,000 grams, which is a little bit over 2 pounds. So that's how that term came about. As we've gotten better and better with being able to establish a true gestational age with early ultrasound in moms, the term, we've begun to think more and more about gestational age, and the term extremely low gestational age newborn, so-called LGAN, or extremely premature infant, has come into being as a way to try to talk about infants who are immature on the basis of their gestational age as opposed to just going by weight. And that tends to be used for infants who are under 28 weeks. But the terms based on weight are ones that have been around for years and years, so people continue to use them. And micropreemie just means the word we use for an extremely small baby.
And that's, if we hear micropreemie, that's 1 3/4 pounds or less? Is that generally correct?
That's somewhere between 1 3/4 and 2 pounds would be that. I think everybody would agree that that's a baby who we'd call a micropreemie.
Okay. Are we focusing too much then when we talk about a term that can be a little bit charged for some, the word viable, but do we focus too much on weeks versus weight then?
I'm not sure I'd say that. For the average baby with the average pregnancy, we know a fair amount about the length of gestation, so that probably in many instances is a better estimate of maturity than weight. That having been said, there are obviously infants who, for one reason or another, we don't know the length of gestation, and then weight becomes very important. But when we talk about viability, one of the major things that determines that is gestational age. It turns out that if you look at the various factors that affect survival, there are other things that play into that. That weight does play into it. Babies who are small for their dates are at higher risk for not being able to survive the newborn period. Other things play into it, like whether a baby is a twin or not. There's not a big difference between twins and between singletons and multiple gestations, but singleton babies tend to do on average a little bit better. I am continually reminded that men are the weaker sex. Girls tend to do a little bit better than boys. And babies whose moms have received betamethasone, which is a steroid to help mature the lungs, do better than babies whose moms haven't. And you can put all of those things into the mix in trying to determine how likely a baby is going to do well. But most people at least start with the gestational age.
Okay, so is there a number in the 20s, then? How many weeks gestation does a baby have to be considered viable? In other words, how many weeks does the baby at birth have to become your neonatal patient?
In Rochester, in 2015, if you are 23 weeks gestation and don't have other complicating factors, and in discussion with your obstetricians and with your parents' obstetricians and neonatologists, the parents have decided that given the very steep and long road that these babies face, that it is reasonable to provide the infant with intensive care. If you're 23 weeks, then we'll be able to provide that intensive care. Below that, really, we feel that there's very little opportunity for these babies to survive and thrive. And right now, we don't offer intensive care for babies who are under 23 weeks gestation.
And there are a number of reasons, as you said, but lung development, is that a big one, as I understand it?
Lung development is the major factor when you talk about lower limit of viability, because in utero, the baby gets nutrition from the placenta, but also the placenta functions like the baby's lungs. The two things lungs need to do is get oxygen in and carbon dioxide out. Once a baby's born and separated from the placenta, the baby's lungs need to do that. And before 23 weeks, the lungs just aren't developed enough to be able to do that long term. So they may be able to do it for a minute, 2 minutes, but not long enough to keep the baby alive. The other issue at less than 23 weeks, when you think about just the sheer size of the baby, and you have to keep a breathing tube in the baby and IVs for nourishment, the babies physically are too small to be able to support them.
Now, the New York Times reports that Iowa, for example, if I have it right, are intervening at 22 weeks. And we talk about community norms for this, and that might surprise some people to hear that there's not sort of a medical standard that is national or international, that there's just sort of a medical understanding of where intervention should happen. But there are community norms, aren't there? Is that fair?
There are community norms. Unfortunately, we live in a community where we have access to the best neonatal care that's possible. Our survival statistics and our morbidity is much better when you compare to national numbers. So it comes down to can your community support the level of care that's needed to keep a 23-weeker alive? And in our community, the answer is yes. In some communities, they don't have the resources that we are fortunate to have here in Rochester, so they can't. So the family either has to decide to physically move to a place that has those types of facilities, or let nature take its course. When you talk about 22 weeks, neonatology really became a field in the 1960s when JFK's son died from premature lung disease, and he was born at 34 weeks. He was over 2 kilos. If he was born today, he most likely surely would have survived. But because we didn't have the ventilator support, the nutrition support, surfactant, which is one of the things that we use to help with the breathing in premature babies. He died at day three of age, and as a result, the United States really focused a lot on keeping these smaller babies alive. So initially, the lower limit of viability was considered 28 weeks because that's where the technology was. And then over time, that lower limit dropped because our technology improved to be able to support those babies. So the survival at 23 weeks is not 100% by any stretch of the imagination, but at least most of those babies have a shot at going home after many, many months in the NICU. Whereas at 22 weeks, the number isn't zero, but it's very, very, very low. So we still consider medical support at 22 weeks to be experimental.
Okay, so 22 weeks, very low. 23 weeks, much better chance than they used to. And 24 weeks for University of Rochester Medical Center, 90% survival rate? 90%.
Correct.
That's remarkable. That is a remarkable number when you consider the JFK Jr. story, the 34 weeks and 4.5 pounds.
Correct.
And they didn't have the capability to provide the care necessary. And now here we are talking about Iowa's trying at 22 weeks. Our number here is 23 weeks. But are we now arriving around where the limit would be realistically? I mean, we're not going to, in 10 years from now, be talking about something in a teen, I would assume.
We won't be talking about the teens in 10 years, but we've both been in neonatology long enough to know that the one thing that's certain is that we're uncertain about the future.
Yeah.
And Dr. Chess and I trained together here in Rochester in an era where the survival for 24-weekers was about 50%, and the survival for 23-weekers was near zero. So things have changed dramatically, and I think that things will continue to change. We don't know how fast, we don't know when, and we don't know what the limits are. Our current technological limits are right there at the 22 to 23-week age. Just below that, there's no technology, but technology keeps changing, and our understanding of medicine and what we can do keeps changing, and it will change. So don't know, but not, I can tell you, not teens in 10 years. Okay. I can promise you that.
Remarkable what we're learning from Dr. Carl Dangio and Dr. Patricia Chess here as we talk about babies born at 22, 23, 24 weeks and what the medical community is able to do. In a moment, we're going to talk about what care entails when that happens. And if you want to call the program, this is Second Opinion Live, and you can call us toll-free at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. If you want to call the program with a question or a comment for our doctors, and if you're listening to us, perhaps you're listening now online or on WXXI, WEOS, or WRUR Radio, or you can watch right now at secondopinion-tv.org. It's part of our Second Opinion series, and thrilled to have them in here as we sort through this. So I'd like to talk about what it entails then. The most urgent single medical issue, if at 22 weeks and younger the issue is lung development, a 23, 24-weeker, what's the most urgent issue most commonly?
In the delivery room, it's still lungs. Mm-hmm. So that's going to make the difference between being able to get a baby out of the delivery room versus not being able to stabilize a baby. So we have a very experienced team that goes to the delivery room, somebody that's skilled with airway management in these very small babies, as small as 500 grams. They put a breathing tube down. They give surfactant, which is a substance that's in everybody's lungs. It's in your lungs. It's in my lungs. Babies that are born very early just don't make enough of it yet. So it's very, very difficult for them to breathe. It's like a balloon that's not inflated. To get it started to be inflated is very difficult. But once you have a partially inflated balloon, it becomes much easier. So what surfactant does is it helps keep the lungs partly inflated so that it's easier to breathe for them. We establish access, which for a baby that's 500 to 700 grams, the most efficient and effective way to establish access is to use the vessels in the belly buttons. So we put in what's called umbilical lines. We put them in a humidified environment because their skin is so immature, they would desiccate if we just kept them in a room like you or I are sitting in. So they're put in a special incubator that has 90% humidity so that they don't desiccate, so that we can keep their electrolytes and blood chemistries within a reasonable limit. They also, when they're very first born at that young gestational age, their intestines aren't working yet. So we have to support them with IV nutrition, but we encourage all moms to pump so that they can eventually give the breast milk to the babies when they're strong enough to eat.
From what I've read, breastfeeding and breast milk at that age for a baby born that small, that young, can be vital, yes?
Yes, it can make the difference between a baby going home and a baby not going home. So okay. We encourage all mothers, and we have close to 100% initiation of breastfeeding for our premature babies because the mothers understand how important that is.
23 to 24 weeks, how long realistically would it take before the baby is able to take a breast versus pumping and being ingesting milk that way?
Initially, the babies are fed when the baby's stable enough to tolerate feeds. We put a tube through the nose into the stomach and feed them that way. But then when they get somewhere between 32 to 34 weeks, if their lungs have improved enough, mm-hmm. they start being able to go to the breast. And our goal, if the moms have continued to pump for that time, by the time they go home, the goal is to start putting them to the breast. They can't totally breastfeed because these babies are so small and they need extra calcium and phosphorus to get their bones stronger, that we supplement even mom's breast milk.
And then medical care, beyond those two big issues of feeding and digestion and lung development, what are the other challenges?
Well, there are a number of challenges. What I tell people is that every system in a premature baby is premature. A couple of the things that tend to face babies in the first few days after they're born, beyond the things that we've already talked about with skin immaturity, lung immaturity, and inability or need for help with their nutrition. Babies are born with a circulation that works best if you're inside of mom, and there's some transitions that need to happen in terms of blood flow between being inside of mom and being outside of mom. In a term baby, that transition kind of happens naturally. We don't think very much about it. In a premature baby, there's a vessel that's supposed to be open inside of mom that tends not to close when they're outside of mom, that inside of mom shunts blood around the lungs because they're not using their lungs inside of mom. And if that stays open when they're outside of mom, blood actually tends to flow in the reverse direction and give them more blood flow to the lungs than they need, and put a lot of stress on their heart. Closing that vessel, that's called a patent ductus arteriosus, and closing that vessel is one of the things that we face oftentimes with these very small babies. So that's one of the things that happens fairly early on. We always worry about infection. Infection is one of the known causes of premature birth, both the infections we usually think of and then some kind of wild and wonderful ones that you don't think about unless you happen to be a neonatologist. So most of these babies need to be treated with antibiotics, at least initially. Getting the intestine ready to feed really works better if you start exposing the intestine to breast milk very early on, within the first couple days, little tiny amounts. But making the transition to having the intestine tolerate all the feeds is sometimes very challenging, and babies can have really significant problems with their intestines that are a result of prematurity.
I just find what you do then remarkable. As you say, a premature baby has every system premature.
Yeah, and that's just the beginning.
That's just the beginning. Really remarkable. And Paul, we have an email from a listener named Paul. And by the way, for our listeners, this hour on Second Opinion Live here on Healthy Friday, you can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. And today you can use the hashtag 2NDOP, 2NDOP. Hashtag any questions or comments, and we can track him down through Twitter there. Paul sends an email says, amazing stuff. Are there typical long-term impacts on health? So he's getting ahead of ourselves as we work our way through the typical life and care. And we were going there eventually, but we're happy to address that now with Drs. Chess and Danjo. Typical long-term impacts?
Yes, is the short answer. Although you can't necessarily predict at the beginning which baby is going to have which problems, babies who are born that prematurely have really very significant risks of having trouble with their learning and development later on. Fortunately for most of them, those problems, although they can be big, are not profoundly disabling, but babies are at risk for problems with their learning, problems with their learning that are so severe they may need to be in a special classroom in school. They're at risk for having trouble with their movement so that they may walk later. It's unusual for them not to walk, but sometimes that happens. They are at risk for problems with their vision. Most of those are treatable. Most of the eye problems of premature babies are treatable, but sometimes babies are left with difficulties with their vision when they're older. And some of those difficulties can't be corrected by glasses, so that these are babies who are going to have a permanent visual impairment. There are risks to hearing as well. So some of these babies end up being hard of hearing and needing hearing aids to help with their hearing. And those lungs that we talked about at the very beginning don't develop the way they would if the baby were still inside of mom. And babies, particularly in the first couple years after they're born, are at big risk for having worse disease with the usual childhood kind of colds and viral illnesses, and are at much greater risk for ending up back in the hospital with those diseases. Fortunately, now we can protect against many of those with vaccines of various types, but they're still at higher risk for coming back in. And those lungs probably are not normal. Even as the children get older and are running around looking fine, if you really stress out the system and test it, they're using more of their lung capacity for the usual events of daily life. They're doing okay because they can do that. But a real unanswered question is what some of these tiny babies are going to be like when our lung capacity naturally begins to diminish once we get into middle age.
Unanswered because we need a larger sample size and more time?
That's correct.
Yeah, because if you're just joining us, as Dr. Danjo said earlier, you know, it wasn't that long ago that even 32, 34 weeks and 4 pounds plus was a big challenge for the medical community. And now we are talking about delivering babies around 24 weeks, sometimes 23 weeks, some states attempting at 22 weeks, and babies under 2 pounds. And so we don't have a large sample size, or at least my guess is the medical community, any scientist always wants as large a sample size as you can, and you need more time.
Correct. And the other thing that I'd add about this is that none of these problems are necessarily going to happen to everyone, and that by and large, these babies and these families thrive and do well. They do well even in the presence of problems that many of us wouldn't necessarily want to have if we could avoid having them. And I think that's an important message, is that for these babies who face so many challenges, the ones who do go home are by and large going to grow up and do okay and be able to adapt to the problems that they may have.
And even at the lower limit of viability that we're talking about, 23, 24, 25 weeks, about a third of those babies are normal. About a third of them have mild disabilities, and about a third of them have significant disabilities. One of the issues is we don't know at the earlier stages when we have to decide whether or not to be aggressive, which third is going to be normal and which third are going to have the bigger problems. But that means that the majority of them are either normal or have mild disabilities. The other thing is we focus on what these babies are increased risk for from a negative aspect, but they also have a decreased risk, and it's been shown in clinical studies, of getting into trouble with drugs and alcohol, and in general, they're found to be much more appreciative of the life that they have because they realize that it's a true gift.
Well, if you want to call the program, you can do that and weigh in with questions or comments as we talk about this issue with our guests here on Second Opinion Live. The number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Here's a comment from a listener right now who knows you well, Dr. Chess. Family went through a lot with you and says, Dr. Chess is the best and unsung miracle worker. We're listening. And so, Dr. Chess, a nice endorsement there. We've got two wonderful guests this hour. Let's get a short break in and come right back on Second Opinion Live as we talk much more about these issues and the medical community's work on them. Next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, I sit down with Jamie Romeo, the new chair of the Democratic Party of Monroe County. She has a very difficult job trying to win elections this year and to win in a place that has been dominated by Republicans for so long. Then second hour, we'll talk about fiction and the Common Core. Is the Common Core pushing out great literature? Talk to you Monday on Connections.
The Iowa State Fair is famous for the presidential candidates who appear at the event every fourth year and the food they eat there, including
ground brisket infused with a white pepper cheese, fresh salsa, jalapenos, a little bit of onion, and it's bacon wrap.
We'll search for healthier items on the fair's menu later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections and Healthy Friday. It's Second Opinion Live. I'm Evan Dawson, and Healthy Friday is being produced in association with the National Public Television show Second Opinion. Today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series. Our guests in studio today are Dr. Patricia Chess and Dr. Carl Danjo, both from the University of Rochester Medical Center and Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. And I'd like to say a special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helps to make Second Opinion Live possible. You can watch this program on the web at secondopinion-tv.org, or you can join the conversation by calling us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can also find us on Twitter using the hashtag 2NDOP. So it's hashtag 2NDOP. We'll be monitoring our Twitter feed throughout the show, and we can get more of your questions or comments to Drs. Chess and Danjo, as we've been doing, as we talk about their neonatal patients and the remarkable progress the medical community has made in the last couple of decades, in being able to provide care for babies born at 24 weeks. And in Rochester, the community standard, as we've been finding out, 23 weeks and 22 weeks and younger, as Dr. Chess said earlier, is considered experimental at this point. But there are some questions about what would cause a baby to be born at that point. Now, doctors, of course, we hear stories about trauma leading to that. The story of a pregnant woman in a car accident, or as we've unfortunately seen in certain cases. What are some of the other reasons that cause babies to need care and to be born early at that stage?
Sometimes moms get an infection, and we typically never figure out exactly where the infection came from. But more often than not, we don't even know why the cervix starts to dilate, and we just have to deal with the side effects of that. Additionally, if mom has significant medical issues, there are times when the risk of mother's health, we have to talk about potentially delivering the baby earlier. Or if the baby is showing signs of distress and problems, it may be the baby's chance of surviving may be better outside the uterus than inside the uterus. So if any of these things start progressing, then we assess what are the baby's chances inside versus outside, and how do we optimize that situation.
How do you have the conversations with the families, with the parents, about possible outcomes from an ethical point of view? And I'm thinking about parents who may have to confront some the kinds of considerations they might not have expected, especially as you heard Dr. Chess say, a third are considered normal, a third mild disability, and a third significant disability of some sort. What are the kinds of conversations you have? How do you approach it?
I try to get a sense from the family where they are and where their family is, and we don't put words into the family's mouth. We're there to support the baby as well as the family. If a mom is threatening to deliver at 23 weeks, obviously it's very, very scary. And some of our moms just say, oh, you know, I can't deal with this. We'll just let nature take its course. But because we have the benefit of the technology that we have in Rochester, I do encourage the families to consider letting us do what we can do and seeing how the baby does, because some of them do quite well. And the parents come back afterwards and say, oh, thank you so much, because now I have this beautiful child that I didn't think that I would have. And we also are thoughtful about first doing no harm. And obviously not all the 23, 24 weekers make it. And if we're supporting a baby and we're needing to support them very aggressively and the baby is telling us, you know, I'm just too young, too immature, I'm not meant to be on this earth, we will help the family and that baby transition in a dignified and peaceful way.
Dr. D'Angelo?
And I'll add that I think many of us in talking to these families really do spend some time trying to understand what this means to them. It's oftentimes very difficult in the setting of being faced with a complication of pregnancy that no one expected, being given a lot of information that can be hard to digest. It's hard for families to take all of that in, but being able to sort out with them whether what they fear most is a baby who has disabilities, who could need a lot of care later on in life, whether what they fear most is losing a baby who might be able to survive, we can help them to sort through some of the things that are most important to them and make a decision that's going to be right for their family. We really believe they're in the best position to make the decisions that are going to be best for them, and ultimately, as a result, best for their baby. And we try to spend some time trying to elicit what's going to be most important for them, what their goals are, and that helps us to help them come to decisions.
I'm going to go to the phones in just a moment. It sounds to me that, and this is not a surprise, but I think it's important to say, that you trust patients by giving them really complete information and allowing them to evaluate.
I think that's fair to say. I also think that it's important for us to remember as physicians and practitioners that we all have the experience of going back the next day and having not only someone not be able to remember what we said, but mm-hmm. not remember that we talked to them at all. So we need to be somewhat judicious in making sure that we're conveying information in a way that people are going to be able to remember it. And even then, sometimes it's hard because it's so traumatic. But if we can help people sort out their preferences and goals, sometimes then that helps us to tailor the information for what's important for them, so that they can extract what is most important for them and get some of the other information a little bit later on.
And we consider the family to be members of the healthcare team, so we encourage them to be present on rounds, and if they have any questions, to ask their questions. So it's not just a one-and-done conversation. It's an ongoing conversation.
It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 to call Second Opinion Live. This is John in Henrietta. Go ahead, John.
Hello. I'm the father of twin premature boys. Not quite as early as we're discussing now. 29 weeks, twin-to-twin transfusion, so low birth weights of 212 and 22. Main question I have is, when speaking about potential long-term issues, I heard the list, I've often read and suspect behavioral issues as a potential side effect. I suppose, I don't know if side effect's a proper term, but I guess my question is that prevalent within the medical community? Is there a belief that there can be behavioral issues, or is that something within the online community they're guessing at?
Go ahead, doctors.
The answer is yes. There certainly can be behavioral issues for babies who are born prematurely, and they can vary from attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, up through fairly significant psychiatric problems. All of those are more common in babies who are born prematurely, and the more premature, the higher the risk. We tend to lump those in with the neurologic disabilities without always thinking as we should about separating them out. But yes, those there are higher risks for those difficulties as well.
And the reason the reason I ask is, as a parent, when we observe these behavioral issues, the question is, are we fighting an uphill battle? Are we fighting against something that is wired in that happened due to this prematurity, or is it having to do with our parenting? Of course, I'm sure parents of all children wonder how much their parenting is.
You're not alone there, John. Yes.
Oh, sure. So that's the constant question. But I do appreciate your time, and I appreciate the subject.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the call. How about the question on sort of wired in, as he described it?
Well, it's an important question to ask, but ultimately what caused it isn't as important as what you're going to do about it, because ultimately what you want is what's best for your child. And having a loving, supportive family, which clearly these twin boys do in the long run, will help these children develop into the best adults that they can be. And so we need to think in terms of, are they going to be straight-A students in math and science at the same rate as a child that wasn't born preterm? Probably not, because there are studies that show their math skills or science skills aren't as good. But there are other things that they can excel at. So identify with your particular child, what are your child's strengths, and help them foster those strengths and help them become the best individual that they were meant to be.
We're going to do our best between now and the end of the hour to get to as many of your questions and comments, and we are getting a lot now, for Drs. Carl Danjo and Patricia Chess from Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong here on Second Opinion Live. I'm going to grab another phone call now. This is Marianne in Rochester. Go ahead, Marianne.
Well, hello. My daughter's expecting quadruplets, and she will be having them at Strong. And it was interesting to hear what you were talking about, the birth survival and all of that, because our goal is to get her to 23 weeks. And then we feel every day after that is going to be a blessing. And then I guess that you want her to deliver by 32 weeks. They're going to be scheduling a C-section. And I'm very interested to hear a little bit more about, you know, their survival rate. I heard you said that it's great odds survival rate after 23 weeks, because we're all nervous, especially with four.
Right. Keep in mind the survival numbers that we were quoting were for singleton babies.
Yeah.
But let me reassure you that having practiced in this community for almost 30 years, if I had one of my own grandchildren that was going to be born prematurely, this is where I would want them to be born. They will get the best care possible.
That's what everybody has said, you know, totally, that Strong is, we're in the best city and to have these babies and all that. Right now she's doing fantastic. Heartbeats are great. They're normal or above normal in growth. She goes to the doctor next Wednesday. In fact, they didn't want to see her for a month because she was doing so well. She was going like every other week or every week for the goal, but now they said, you know, she's been doing wonderfully. And it's just amazing. We just can't believe there's four.
Well,
there's three boys and a girl.
So Marianne, stay on the line and let me ask the doctors to kind of consider the question then. She said their understanding is 23 weeks, and after that, every day is a blessing. Is that kind of a good framework to approach this?
Well, I often talk to families who are in this situation of expecting that it's likely that a delivery will happen before term. And it is true that the first milestone is 23 weeks, because then it is at least reasonable to think that we might be able to help the babies survive. And then at 23 weeks, yes, every day is a blessing because the survival curve is very steep between 23 and 24 weeks. In our community right now, if you look at all the babies that we've taken care of in the last 6 or 7 years, about 40% of the babies who are born at 23 weeks will survive to go home. But we know that if you look at all comers for the last several years, at 24 weeks, that number is 90%, and the number goes up from there.
Wow.
That's
nice to hear.
Yeah. So that, yes, it at first it's days, and then you want to get another week, and eventually I'm sure we'll have a chance to meet these little ones, but we hope it'll be a long time.
Yeah, they said they want them to be delivered before November 23rd, which is the 32nd week. They don't want her to go past 32 weeks.
Well, you know, I will say, Marianne, talking not only to the doctors here, but our remarkable medical community, you've got great people around you, and we're all pulling for you. Thanks for calling the program today, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much. We're very excited.
You should be excited for. That's going to be a lot of excitement for a long time. Marianne calling Second Opinion Live here. A number of other questions are coming in here, and I want to kind of lump two together here if I could. Karen says, as a parent, it must be alarming to see your baby being kept alive by these measures. What support is there for parents? Jenna on Twitter says, do the doctors consider the stress on the parents watching a micro struggle to survive? My friend had one. So similar questions. How would you answer that?
I make a point of touching base with my extremely preterm baby's parents on a regular basis and offer availability. We also have 3 social workers that work full-time in the NICU. Our nurses are fabulous at providing support for the families. But we also have continuous assessment of the baby's reaction to pain and stress. And we are very aggressive in treating if there are signs of pain and distress in the babies.
I'll add that it's absolutely true that having a premature baby is a roller coaster for a parent. And it's a roller coaster that can have really big ups and really big downs. Some of them are related to how the baby's doing. Some of them aren't. We're very aware of that and very aware of how difficult this is for parents. We do the best that we can to support parents up to and including referring them if needed for psychological or psychiatric help, because it really can be very difficult. But unfortunately, some of that is unavoidable. It is just it's very difficult being a parent to watch your child in harm's way, and to have to do that day after day for weeks is very, very wearing on folks. And we do everything we can to support them, but we recognize that sometimes that isn't enough, and it's still very hard.
We also have a parent-to-parent support group. So parents that had the experience of having extremely premature and very critically ill babies in the unit volunteer their time and meet and speak with parents that are going through it now to share their experience and to help them.
What is the age that you can green light skin-to-skin contact?
It varies a little bit, depending on how medically fragile the baby is. Perhaps a better way to think about that is, what are the things that would prevent us from being able to have that happen? Babies who need a lot of support for their breathing, sometimes being moved at all is very stressful, and getting them moved to be in skin-to-skin contact, even if they might do well once they get there, is a risk that it may not be worth taking. But in general, once these babies are more stable from the point of view of their respiration and if their blood pressure is okay and their heartbeat is okay, we really encourage parents to do what we call kangaroo care, getting the baby up against mom's or dad's skin. They tend to really do remarkably well, even if they're very small. So there's not a bottom weight or a bottom gestational age. It has more to do with their medical circumstances.
It's 844-295-TALK as we try to fit in as many of your questions here on Second Opinion Live for our doctors who are here in studio with us talking about premature birth and all of the many complicated issues that go along with that. And, you know, I think we're going to try to grab one more quick phone call here and in just a second. This is George in Rochester, and let me go ahead and grab George. Go ahead, George.
Hi. You were speaking about premature babies and talking about the parental perspective, and I'm actually a premature baby. I'm 30 years old now, and I figured maybe end on a high note. There's light at the end of the tunnel, and things can turn out okay. I mean, I'm perfectly fine. I was 3 months premature and 2 pounds and like a little tiny bit, and, you know, good things happen.
Wow. Thank you, George. You say you're 30 years old?
Yep.
So let's see, you're 30
and
years old.
I was actually born that strong.
1985, and you were born just over 2 pounds and you said 3 months early, so I'm trying to do math here. So you're in the mid to high 20s in weeks, 28 weeks or so?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Wow. And how have you been, if I can ask?
As best as anyone can really be. I mean, everybody's got their own individual issues, but, you know, I don't have any major problems. I'm not hurting in any way. I've had a normal life.
Wow. Doctors, and I guess that's just a thumbs-up good news story. Anything you want to say to George?
Thank you very much for the call, and that's our goal. And great. Congratulations.
Yeah.
And not infrequently, parents of former preemies will bring their preemies back to visit. And then eventually it gets to the point where the preemies themselves come back. And we recently had a marriage between two of our preemies, which was a lot of fun.
Wow, what a story. George, thank you. Good luck to you. It sounds like you're doing great. And that's a really nice note to help put our show towards the backside. So thank you very much.
Not a problem. Have a good day.
30 years old. Just over 2 pounds, and the world was different in 1985, caring for a 2-plus-pounder, as our doctors have told us. You know, I want to ask the next question without putting any blame on parents, but is there anything you would advise moms especially to do to try to make sure that they don't end up delivering that far preterm?
Keep on top of your prenatal visits. Visit your OB. If possible, it's a good idea to see your OB before you even get pregnant, because some of the issues that babies can have, if you get started on prenatal vitamins and possibly some extra folate, can minimize the risk of some of the complications. But unfortunately, some moms go into preterm labor and no reason. But the other thing I would mention is if you're a smoker, try to get off cigarette smokes. Just not only for the pregnancy, but so that you see your child graduating from high school.
Yeah, how about not smoking forever would be good. Anything you want to add there, Dr. Danjo?
I think that I would echo that so many of the cases that where we see moms, there is nobody who has done anything other than exactly what they should have done. And I don't want people to feel as if anything that we're suggesting is a surefire preventive for prematurity. But one of the other things that I will mention is that over the last 10 years or so, we've come to understand that in mothers who've delivered a preterm baby previously, getting to those OB appointments early and getting treated with progesterone actually decreases the rate of repeat premature delivery. And that's another really important reason to see your OB early on.
Here's another. Oh, Dr. Chess, go
yes,
ahead.
And yes. Just another point on the other side of it, about 10% of our term babies are delivered by elective repeat C-section now. So wait until you're 39 weeks, unless there's an indication to deliver before that.
Here is a comment from Joseph, an email, and he says, I'm a male twin, a preemie, born in 1952 at 20-something weeks, not sure of our weights at birth. Both babies were very sickly, and each remained in the hospital for many weeks and months. In the first days, I contracted an infection which resulted in a near congenital orthopedic disability. Mom weighed just 99 pounds at birth, when she took a fall down steps and induced birth. However, instruments were necessary to deliver, which may have been the source of the infection. Is there a place for individuals to confer with current physicians and scientists to learn more and perhaps contribute to ongoing research? That's from Joe.
Very good question. I think certainly folks who want to learn more could call our Division of Neonatology at Golisano Children's, and we could talk about what we might be able to do and talk about. And we are certainly very interested in the longer-term outcomes. We've gone now from 30 years to, if my math is right, 60 years of follow-up here. Knowing how those babies are doing now in adulthood actually is an important thing. I'm involved with some of our research activities, and knowing how people do long-term is an important part of it. So we'd welcome a call.
I just want to close by asking you about infant mortality rates in general, where they are now, and especially where they've come from. I've got about a minute left here. Dr. Chess, perhaps, or Dr. Danjo?
Yeah, I can take that one. So infant mortality has to do with a number of factors. We're very good at keeping our 23-weekers alive and giving them the best shot. But poverty is actually associated with very high infant mortality. And as you know, our community is very blessed in some ways, but it has one of the highest poverty rates in the country. So our infant mortality rate is higher than many other communities, and we are actively working with the community on improving those numbers.
Although premature infants account for a good portion of what's called neonatal mortality, that mortality in the first 28 days, infant mortality really, as Dr. Chess says, depends a lot on other factors, and things that will help people who are disadvantaged socially to access medical care and to be more advantaged will really make the difference.
What an interesting and important hour of discussion with Drs. Carl Danjo and Patricia Chess. And Dr. Chess, thank you so much for taking the time to come in for us.
And one more point. Back to sleep. Very important to reduce the risk of SIDS.
Back to sleep. Okay. Dr. Danjo, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
It's been wonderful having both of you here on Second Opinion Live as part of Healthy Friday. Our thanks especially to the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support, of course, helps to make Second Opinion Live possible. Hope you've been watching through the web, secondopinion-tv.org. And thanks to the full team behind not only Second Opinion Live, Healthy Friday, John Andrus, the engineer behind the glass today. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you so much for listening and watching on member-supported public radio.